Welcome to the Minnesota Military Radio Hour, where we bring you information about Minnesota's National Guard, military community, Beyond the Yellow Ribbon Program, and Department of Veteran Affairs. Your host is Tom Lyons, the founder and owner of Phalon Partners Limited, a Twin Cities merger and acquisition advisory firm. Tom is also a Vietnam veteran of the United States Air Force and a member of the VFW and American Legion. Now the host of Minnesota Military Radio Hour, Tom Lyons.
Welcome to the Minnesota Military Radio Hour. I'm Tom Lyons. In today's show, we talk to Dr. Hiram Mann, a retired lieutenant colonel and an original Tuskegee Airman, an author about being a Tuskegee Airman. And we take a look back at Black History Month with Lieutenant Colonel Troncy Williams of the Department of Military Affairs, Minnesota National Guard. But first, it's time for Generally Speaking, a weekly message from the Adjutant General of the Minnesota National Guard, Major General Rick Nash.
The military spouse is part of an adaptable, resilient, educated, and dedicated workforce. The majority of military spouses work outside of the home to supplement their family income and wish to stay in their current career of choice, regardless of relocation or a change in family situation caused by deployments and other military commitments. A recent study revealed that 93% of military spouses suffered from pay disparities. By presidential executive order, the Office of Personnel and Management is continuing to assess and advance federal employment mechanisms for improving hiring trends for military spouses. This includes preparation, training, and a veterans and spouses preference. The Department of Labor also offers priority of service to veterans and military spouses via their website, careeronestop.org/military-transition. Again, www.careeronestop.org/military-transition. This program can help military spouses in their job search, provide career counseling, and sharpen job interview and other related skills. The program also leverages private sector partnerships to connect veterans and military spouses with potential employers. In addition, post-9/11 GI benefits can be passed to spouses as well as children by eligible service members or veterans. In addition, the VA offers education counseling as well as some accessibility to stipends for those pursuing portable career opportunities at entry-level positions. More information on these programs can be found at va.gov. Because of the high tempo of deployments and over 19,000 members of the Minnesota National Guard who have deployed overseas, it's vital that we provide professional support to our military spouses. They are the backbone of our force and the first link in the support system for deployed soldiers and airmen.
Thank you, General Nash. You can link to the Adjutant General's blog, Facebook, and Twitter feed through MinnesotaNationalGuard.org/generallyspeaking. This week, Dr. Hiram Mann joins us. He's a retired lieutenant colonel. He was one of the original Tuskegee fighter pilots for the 332nd and the 99th Fighter Squadrons during World War II for the Army. Colonel Mann, welcome to the Minnesota Military Radio Hour.
Well, thank you so very much. My pleasure.
Sir, some of our listeners might not be familiar with the Tuskegee Airmen. Can you tell us about them?
I'll be happy to. We were the first black African-American or colored Negro, whichever you want to designate us as being, military pilots. Prior to World War II, there were no black, colored, Negro, or whatever you want to call us, military pilots. All of us, I'm sure all of your listeners are aware of segregation and what used to exist. I'll use the hypothetical below the Mason-Dixon line. I know those of you in Minneapolis, for my exposure to you, you had no rigid segregation from my exposure, from what I know, and post-war. But prior to World War II, Negroes were not, I'll use Negro because I like that better than the others. Negroes were not permitted to get into the Army Air Corps. At that time, there was no Air Force. The Air Force did not come into being until September of 1947, after World War II had ended. But it took me 3 attempts to get into the flying training program. I wanted to fly for my country. This is my country, too. And I wanted to do what I could to keep the Nazis away from the shores of America. I had a wife, a mother, and a grandmother. And I did not want the Nazis coming to the United States of America and committing the atrocities on the females in America that they were committing on the females in Europe. So I attempted to volunteer to get into a flying training program. And no, I had never been near an airplane in my life. I was born in 1921. Well, that makes me almost 90 years old. And I was a pre-Depression era child. To me, pennies were very scarce. My family was not affluent, and we were not quite dirt poor, but we were poor. And I had no idea what I should have studied before I attempted to get into the Army Air Corps to be a pilot. So I wrote a letter asking for information, and the first letter of rejection that I received said in no uncertain terms there were no facilities to train Negroes to fly in any branch of the American military service. That kicked pause me off, because I thought anybody could get into the service very easily. And then I heard that the United States was going to start a program to train Negroes to fly. And I applied the second time. That letter of rejection was a form letter sent to anyone who did not qualify. And it said, well, that's what opened my eyes to not having done my homework before I wrote these letters. But this second letter of rejection was a form letter sent to anyone who did not qualify. That letter said basically, for anyone to get into a flying training program in the American military system, they must have completed a minimum of 2 years of college, and they must be single. And I see there I was with 3 strikes against me. I was married. I married in 1940. I had only 1 year of college, and I was black. I went back to doing my job as a bellman in Hotel Cleveland, Cleveland, Ohio, and I heard that they had dropped those 2 controllable restrictions, and it now stood that anyone who could pass the rugged mental and physical examinations could get into an American flying training program. So I applied the third time. That time I was successful. I passed the test. I do have my last 2, the second letter of rejection among my records. And I have the third record, letter saying that it's dated December 7, 1942, 1 year after Pearl Harbor. And it took 18 months for them to finally reach me with a quota slot. They say there was no quota, but anytime you have only one place, and a lot of people are trying to get into that one place, you have to limit it by establishing a maximum number. When you establish that number, you have automatically established a quota slot. And that basically, I'm rambling, talking facts, but that is what it was like prior to World War II, or prior to the Executive Order 9981, which President Truman signed in 1947. basically, that letter said there will be no no stated a different way, there will no longer be segregation in the American military system. Because of my group, the 332nd Fighter Group, and our performance, when we showed them that we could perform as well as any other Americans in the flying training program, that was a precursor to ending segregation in the American military system, which later led to ending segregation in industry. Have I answered that question?
Colonel Mann, you did a wonderful job, and it sounds like you're a determined man. We're going to have to take a short break here because this is radio, and we'll continue our conversation with you in a moment, and maybe we can hear a little bit about your training and your missions in World War II.
I'll stay on the line.
Yes, sir.
Let me know when you're ready.
We'll be right back with Colonel Hiram Mann. This is the Minnesota Military Radio Hour on News Talk 100.3 FM. 100.3 FM.
Straighten up and fly right. Straighten up and stay right.
Welcome back to the Minnesota Military Radio Hour. Today we're talking to Dr. Hiram Mann, a retired lieutenant colonel and one of the original Tuskegee Airmen. He's also an author. Colonel Mann?
I'm here.
You were telling us about how determined you were to get into the Army Air Corps program. Can you tell us a little bit about the training program you went through?
I definitely can. Our training, our meaning the training of Negroes when they finally let us into the flying training program. The only difference in our training and the training of our white counterparts as cadets was we had all of our training at the one airfield, Tuskegee Army Air Corps in Tuskegee, Alabama. It was selected because Tuskegee Institute, which is now Tuskegee University, Tuskegee Institute had one of the six Tuskegee Institute was one of the six institutions of high black institutions of higher learning, which had a civil air patrol or civilian flying as part of its curriculum. Now, by comparing the training of the Negro pilots to training of the white pilots, I refer to them as our counterparts, our training was exactly the same. Maxwell Army Air Base, or now Maxwell Airfield, was in charge of training prior to and during World War II. And they established the curriculum that all pilots would have. How much time in basic, as a basic soldier, we were soldiers before airmen, how much time as a basic soldier, how much time as a pre-flight, pre-aviation cadet. I was in the first group that established, after they established the five-month college training program, we had our 5 months at Tuskegee Institute in Alabama. Then we went into pre-flight, then for 2.5 months, primary for 2.5 months, basic flying, 2.5 months, and advanced flying, 2.5 months. With that 5 months college training added on, it amounted to a training of approximately 14.5 months. That from the time we went in as pre-aviation students through the aviation cadet until graduation as second lieutenants was approximately 14.5 months. Now, I tell all you parents who have start before teenage children. Try to get them to establish what they would like to do. And don't let anyone tell them they can't do something when they know they can do it. Go out and prove to them that they can do these certain things that they really want to do. And I say also, be sure that they are prepared when they go out and volunteer to do something or say they want to do something, ask for a certain job. Don't just accept, you can't do that, you can't do that, or this is too difficult for you. But be prepared when they go to apply for it. Now, I was saying that our training was identical. Maxwell Army Air Field, or later Maxwell Air Force Base, was in charge of the curriculum, the courses we studied, the ground school courses we had, as well as the flying courses. And ours was ours, meaning the training of the Negro Army Air Corps pilots, was identical to that training the white pilots. I don't know how many of you may have seen the movie The Tuskegee Airmen, which Lawrence Fishburne, Cuba Gooding, and Anthony Vance and others play in. My only claim to fame in that movie is that a classmate of mine wrote the script for that movie. But it is not a documentary, but it does depict the difficult time we had, we meaning Negroes again, getting into the flying training program, and the difficult time we had establishing or proving that we could do it. Those of you who may have seen it know the can see how we were treated in the beginning, and later it is true that we became one of the most requested units to fly escort for our white bomber pilots. There were no black Negro bomber pilots, so that those we flew escort for, and we protected. We were fighting for the freedom or liberation of people in Europe when we were not free back here in our own country. But later we broke that barrier, and we received the Congressional Gold Medal for our participation in World War II. We got it 65 years late, but at least we did get it. Those of us who were still alive did receive that Congressional Medal.
We're speaking.
Did I answer that part?
We're speaking with retired Lieutenant Colonel Hiram Mann, a fighter pilot for the Army's Tuskegee Airmen and author, on Minnesota Military Radio Hour here on News Talk 100.3 FM. Colonel Mann, I understand you were one of the original Tuskegee Airmen in the 332nd Fighter Group and that you flew 48 missions.
Well, yes, correct. But that's one of the things I did want, two things I wanted to clarify to our audience. We were not called Tuskegee Airmen until 1972. Prior to that, well, people ask me, well, what were you called? Those of us that proved ourselves, really got into the combat and the battle, and proved that Negroes were as smart as our white counterparts, were the 332nd Fighter Group. We didn't get the name Tuskegee Airmen, and it's used retrospectively now, going back to the beginning of all through our training. We are referred to as the Tuskegee Airmen, but we were just called Black Pilots of World War II, and toward the end of the war, the fighter pilots flew Red Tail P-51s, and we were in the part of the 15th Air Force. We were one of the squadrons of one of the groups of the 15th Air Force. There were four groups in the 15th fighter groups. The 31st was a yellow and black, either candy stripe or checkerboard. The 52nd was a solid yellow tail empennage. The 325th fighter group was a yellow and black, the opposite, either checkerboard or candy stripe. And the 332nd fighter group, the last to be established, my group, was a solid red tail. We can't find out who said we should fly a red tail instead of having some configuration of yellow and black. I've thought of many ways it could have been configured in the same colors if it wanted to be, but that's beside the point.
Sir, I'm told that your plane was named Boss Lady. Can you tell me where that came from?
Yes. I mentioned that I was married. I married in 1940, before America got into the war. and frequently, or occasionally maybe, I referred to my wife. Incidentally, I have the bride of 71 years here with me in Titusville, Florida. And they thought ours, we eloped. They thought ours was a mandatory situation, but it was not. Ours was a Romeo and Juliet, which still goes on today. And I named my plane Boss Lady after my bride. And she is still referred to as Boss Lady. That's her title.
Sounds like you mean that, sir.
Well, it's lasted almost 71 years, and no point in quitting now.
Now, your airplane that was called Boss Lady, was that a P-51 Mustang?
It was a P-51D. I had two planes. I say had. My first plane was lost. A friend of mine in my fighter group was flying it and was shot out of the air. And I've often thought about Arnett Starks. I'll never forget him. There, but for the grace of God, could I have been? I probably may not have been in this identical spot that he was in when the plane was shot up, but he was flying my plane. We say my plane, but that plane belonged to, at that time, I think the population of the United States was somewhere reaching for 150 million. Well, that plane belonged to 150 million Americans, not just mine. But Starks came to me at breakfast that morning and said they had him scheduled to fly my plane again. Was that okay? What was I to say? No, you can't fly. But no, he was a good buddy of mine. And when that mission took off, Starks was among those to take off. And when the mission returned, Starks was not among them. So that I received the second P-51D. And in my naivete, I did not know that that plane should have been named Boss Lady Number 2. I named it Boss Lady also. So yes, Boss Lady was the name of my plane. On the pictures you'll see of me, but standing in front of number 92, that was the second Boss Lady.
Colonel, you sound like you're still ready to fly a mission today. We have to take a short break. Can you stay with us for a few more minutes?
Oh, what time? Yes, I can. I'll be here. I'm talking what I love to talk about.
You're doing a great job. We'll continue with our conversation with retired Lieutenant Colonel and Dr. Hiram Mann after a short break. This is the Minnesota Military Radio Hour on News Talk 100.3 FM.
Straighten up and fly right. Straighten up and stay right. Straighten up and fly right. Cool down, Papa, don't you blow your top.
Welcome back to the Minnesota Military Radio Hour. Today we're talking with retired Lieutenant Colonel Hiram Mann, one of the original Tuskegee Airmen, and an author about the topic. Colonel Mann, we're also joined in the studio by Lieutenant Colonel Trancy Williams. I understand you two know each other.
Very well. He's a good friend of mine, and this narration that you want to hear is his favorite among my tales I enjoy telling about my experiences. Are you ready for me to go ahead?
Well, let me just give a little better introduction this week. Lieutenant Colonel Trancy Williams joins us. He's the State Equal Employment Manager from the Department of Military Affairs, Minnesota National Guard. Colonel Williams, thanks for joining us today, and we've got your friend Colonel Mann with us.
My pleasure. Good to be talking about this topic. It's always great to talk with Colonel Mann.
I think you had a follow-up question for him about a mission.
Colonel Mann, he knows which one is my favorite mission, but I was wondering if you can tell them about our trip to Berlin and meeting the World War II German pilots, particularly the one.
That one first, before we go into the first strafing mission.
Okay, we can do your first strafing mission then.
The one that Colonel Williams liked so well. This was 60 55 years ago. Now, I'll try to remember it as it happened, but it goes to the except new pilots, when you went over, when I finally got into the military flying, I was in the 27th class to graduate. I mentioned that I had tried to get in before Negroes were permitted to join the Army Air Corps. But by the time I got in, quite a few others had gotten in. The other classes had graduated. I mentioned I was in the 27th class. A class graduated each month. I mentioned that our curriculum followed the what was set down by Maxwell Army Air Field. And it went something like, as new pilots replacement were sent over as replacements, they were added into a squadron. Our group had four squadrons to begin. When I begin, the 99th Pursuit Squadron was the first group to go over, first group of Negro pilots to go overseas. They were mistreated by the groups they were attached to. The 332nd Fighter Group was being formed back in the States, and Colonel Davis and Benjamin O. Davis Jr., the son of the first Negro general in the Army, Benjamin O. Davis Sr., Benjamin O. Davis Jr. had spent 4 years at West Point in virtual silence. None of his white classmates or instructors spoke to him except in the line of duty. And he slept alone, ate alone, everything except the classroom in which he was integrated, but they only spoke to him for official classroom duties. When he graduated from the point, one is supposed to be able to select the service they want. When Benjamin O. Davis Jr. was asked, he wanted to join the Army Air Corps. They did not permit him to join the Corps because there were no Negroes in the Army Air Corps for him to be over. His crew chief and all would have been white. And at that time, they did not want, they meaning the government and the high mucky mucks in the military, did not want white enlisted personnel serving under Negro officers. Now, back to my first strafing mission. I had had all the maneuvering put through, all the various maneuvers that one may get into while flying combat. The loops, the spins, the strafing, the dive bombing, the skip bombing, and various things. So I knew what it was all about. Well, when I joined this group, I was initially assigned to the 302nd Fighter Squadron of the 332nd Fighter Group. And I did about five missions of milk run type escort service, being well protected by those ahead of me. I can't say older than I was, because I was older than quite a few of my upperclassmen, but those who were ahead of me knew the ropes more or less. And we went into this particular mission, and there was only one green string going on the map, of our combat area, and the pilots that had been there longer than I had were giving off expletives, and I didn't understand why. And they explained to me that that one line, one red yarn line going from our base up into enemy territory, meant it was going to be a strafing mission. While I had strafing back in the States, I knew what strafing was. You fly in low at full speed, select the target, and fire on it. So we went out to the plane, and my crew chief was standing beside Boss Lady again. This was the first Boss Lady, a P-51D model. A D model has six 50 caliber machine guns, three in each wing, synchronized or aimed about 250 yards in front of the nose of the propeller. That spreads the firepower on the far side of the aiming point. The fifth bullet in each gun was an incendiary bullet. It had been dipped, the tip had been dipped in phosphorus, and when the hammer strikes the firing pin, the back of the gun, it causes the missile part of the bullet as it goes out to give off a silver streak. That phosphorus is burning. That aids you, aids the pilot in aiming his gun. So we had received the briefing of all the cogent things we needed to know, what to wear in case we were shot down, and hopefully get into the partisans in Europe to get in touch with us and get us back safely to the Allied. We had a chit with money in it and all those sorts of things that we needed. So it's the 6x6 truck took us from the briefing room to the revetment and dropped us off at our planes. My chief was there, and he and I had small talk. I asked, how did it fly? How did it run when he revved up the engine and did the necessary pre-flight and the talk? So I put two sticks of chewing gum in my mouth before my chief assisted me onto the wing, and I climbed into the cockpit, and he assisted me in strapping the parachute and my seat belt and all the necessary prerequisites to taking off. Well, the mission took off. We won't go into detail about that. And we got over enemy territory, and the flight leader, usually flew four men to a flight. We went over as a squadron, the group of the squadron, and when we got into enemy territory, we broke into flights of four to go looking for the targets of opportunity. And we flew over a train yard or something, and our leader, group leader, sighted a train down in a marshaling yard, and he called for us to jettison or get rid of our external tanks and get into echelon. Echelon is when you get into a string out to the left or right. And the leader usually selects the lead, the engine on a train, and as they go down, you select a boxcar. Well, we jettisoned the external tanks and went into the dive. That's full forward on your throttle, much like stopping down on the accelerator of an automobile. You want maximum speed, and then that dive assists you in gaining speed. I don't know how fast I was going, probably 450, 500 miles an hour. This was not a jet, so that was fast speed for us. And I picked out the boxcar I was going to fire on, and you fire in short bursts. You don't sustain a long, short bursts, squeezing the trigger a little at a time. And you can see your bullets. That fifth bullet helps you in aiming. That incendiary bullet helps you in aiming. You aim low and bring the nose of the plane up, so you want to hit your target. And I could see my bullets going out in front of me, and I happened to notice that silver streaks were going past me. And that first thought was, geez, I must be flying faster than my bullets. Then reality struck in. I realized that the enemy was shooting at me. We had never had that training back in the States, faced live fire or even simulated live fire coming toward us. I've been asked frequently, why didn't you get out of there? Turn and go. Any way you turn, you expose more of the airplane to the enemy fire than you do if you head straight into it. You're the least vulnerable to be hit by going straight toward the source of firepower. Well, we completed that mission, and we went seeking other targets of opportunity, and we finally joined up and went back to our home field. When we landed, my crew chief was there. there waiting for me, and the rest of the crew chiefs were ready to greet their pilots, those that returned, and they get on the wing and ride back to the revetment, helping you steer the plane. P-51 is nose high. You can't see over that nose looking straight ahead. You have to zigzag if you don't have someone guiding you, helping you keep on the taxi strip. We guided, my crew chief guided me to my revetment and assisted me in how to turn to park it the way he wanted and gave me the signal to cut engine. Well, I cut the engine. He hopped on the wing of the plane and I opened the canopy. He helped me get out of the gear. I didn't get weak or notice what had happened. The excitement that I had been in under this combat until I stepped out onto the wing of the plane, and that's when my knees turned to rubber. The adrenaline had been pumping so rapidly. When I unhooked my oxygen mask, we took off and landed, always using oxygen, because you never knew when you were going to maybe get above 10,000 feet, and the requirement was to use your oxygen above 10,000 feet. But when I unhooked my mask and stepped out onto the wing, my knees just buckled under me. I realized the excitement that I had been in, my first taste of enemy fire. And that was a real, I had chewed that gum so forcefully. Colonel Williams liked this part about it. I had chewed that gum so forcefully, I no longer had a wad of two sticks of gum. I had a mouthful of little BBs. I had chewed the gum. I had chewed all of the cohesion out of that two sticks of chewing gum.
Colonel Mann, you've flown 48 missions, and you served in the service for 21 years before you got out. We're just about out of time today. Any final thoughts for our listeners about your career in the service and your incredible life?
Well, I actually had 30 years of service. That letter I mentioned, I went in 1942, and I was mandatorily retired in 1972. I had 28 years of commissioned service, but I had not made full bird in 06. I'd been recommended for promotion to 06, but the mandatory retirement date arrived before the promotion board met, and I was retired as Lieutenant Colonel. I would love to have stayed in a bit longer because the service was wonderful life to me, and I encourage all young men to get at least have that period of discipline, learn what it means to take orders, and then you're able to give orders. And to young people, I say, don't let anyone take your education away from you. Get as much education as you can. They can't take it away from you. And with those few words, I wish all of you good luck, and I hope this mess over in the Persian Gulf gets over soon so that our boys can come home.
Colonel Mann, thank you for your service to our country, and thanks for joining us today with these stories of your days as a Tuskegee Airman looking back.
Talk to you soon.
Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity. I love to talk about it.
Thank
you. Very good luck to you, too, and all of our listeners.
Thank you, sir. We have to go to a break now, but when we return, we'll be back with the Commissioner's Corner, and we'll be talking to Lieutenant Colonel Troncy Williams about Black History Month. And this is the Minnesota Military Radio Hour on News Talk 100.3 FM. Welcome back to the Minnesota Military Radio Hour. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Lyons. It's time for the Commissioner's Corner, a weekly update from the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. Now here's Commissioner Larry Shelato.
February is Black History Month, and I want to take a moment to honor our African American veterans, those serving today and those who have served throughout history. African Americans have played a significant role in U.S. military history over the past 300 years, despite adversity and limited opportunities. Again and again, they were denied military leadership roles and skill training Before 1940, African Americans were actually barred from officially flying for the U.S. military. However, during World War II, civil rights organizations in the black community exerted pressure. It was this force that resulted in an all-black pursuit squadron based in Tuskegee, Alabama in 1941. These brave, skilled pilots became known as the legendary Tuskegee Airmen. Tuskegee Airmen endured racial discrimination both within and outside the U.S. Army. Yet, they trained and flew with distinction. This past treatment of African Americans in the U.S. military is shameful, and there's no secret that we as a country have not done a good enough job in telling the incredible story of the Tuskegee Airmen. Unfortunately, like so many of our World War II veterans, the remaining Tuskegee Airmen are now in their 80s and 90s. Most are physically unable to appear at events to tell their story. As I mentioned earlier, February is Black History Month. But this is a group we should honor and remember 365 days a year. It is disheartening that many of our veterans right here in Minnesota, including African American veterans, female veterans, and homeless veterans, are still not aware of the benefits they have earned through their military service. While our Programs and Services Division has built several successful programs and partnerships to reach out to our diverse communities across the state, we still have work to do. As Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, it is my personal mission to get the word to everyone who has served. Find out what you have earned. Contact us today at 1-888-LINK-VET or online at minnesotaveteran.org.
Commissioner Shalado, you can find out more about the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs programs by calling 1-888-LINK-VET or online at minnesotaveteran.org. Our in-studio guest this week has been Lieutenant Colonel Troncy Williams. He is the State Equal Employment Manager from the Department of Military Affairs, Minnesota National Guard, and a good friend of our friend now, Colonel Hiram Mann, who joined us this morning. Colonel Williams, sounds like Colonel Mann can still fly a mission.
Oh, yes. He's currently driving this hover around the house, crashing into things, but he enjoys the joystick of that. And Colonel Mann's a great American.
Colonel, we were supposed to be talking about Black History Month, as well as the Tuskegee Airmen, and we've got a good taste of their days in World War II from Colonel Mann. What does Black History Month mean to you, and what can you tell us about it?
Absolutely. As Colonel Mann told his story, Black History is a chance for people to tell their story. History, her story, our story, American story. That's what the history is about, because it gives us a chance as African Americans to focus on the left out part of our story. And it gives the community, society, Americans a chance to see our accomplishments. And then from our accomplishments, you get a chance to say, hey, they are relevant. They are reliable. They are part of our society. So history gives us a chance to look at that. So that's why African American history, Black history is very important to American history.
That, Colonel, things have changed dramatically since Colonel Mann was trying to get into the Army Air Force in World War II. And as you and I talked earlier, it's changed dramatically just since the Vietnam War. Can you help us understand how those changes, what they mean to you today as an officer in the Minnesota National Guard?
Well, those changes that happened because of the perseverance, the patience, the persistence, the hard work and dedication of the men that came before us, whether it was the Buffalo Soldiers, the Tuskegee Airmen, the Triple Nickel, the Harlem Hellfighters, those individuals whose shoulders I stand on today, who set the pavement, who ran their part of the race and passed their torch or passed the baton on to me to continue in that legacy and to leave a legacy of my own for the future generations. So what they've done to get us where we are is not good enough to take us where we need to be. So I need to continue with their struggles and to continue to make progress.
So Black History Month really gives you a reminder each year to tell the story of all of those accomplishments and as far as we've come.
At least the month is accented. However, I use it every single day, 365. I make sure that I live my life the way that those that came before me will want me to live my life, to be a perfect living example.
Colonel, is there a key lesson to be pulled when we review these things?
Always, as the song says, straighten up and fly right. We got to continue to straighten up and fly right, to stay on a path, to make sure our azimuth is consistently checked and that we're doing the right things for the right reasons.
And how long have you known Colonel Mann?
Oh, I've known Colonel Mann for at least, I've known of him for a long time. I had the pleasure of meeting him in 1999. And we've been buddies since. We've got a chance to travel Europe. I had a chance to take him over to Berlin to make sure that we are to meet up with the fighter pilots that he fought against in World War II, Germany. And we've been traveling all over the United States together. Colonel Thomas and myself, we call ourselves Three to Hard Way. We do a lot of Black History tours and events all over the nation and all over the world.
And Colonel, how does all of this tie into one of your jobs is that of State Equal Employment Manager for the Department of Military Affairs?
Well, it falls under outreach, and it falls under awareness, and it falls under making sure that we have visibility, bringing visibility to the Minnesota National Guard, visibility to our inner cities, visibility to our communities, to make sure that they see a role model such as themselves so they can see that they also can be and reach those goals that seem so far and unattainable. We don't want just to be recognized on television. We want them to see that they're real, live, living people from their communities, just like them, went to the schools that they've gone to, and that they can achieve, they can believe, and they can conceive all of these great things that the men and women that came before us did.
Colonel Mann gave us a loud message this morning. He was determined to get into the Army Air Force, and his last message was, what do you think his last message was for the young people today that might be thinking about going into the Minnesota National Guard?
Preparation. You got to be prepared. Preparation to continue to excel and never give up. We need winners and not whiners. So it's not for everybody, but those that think this may be for them, we need you to be prepared.
And Colonel, you're a Lieutenant Colonel of the Minnesota National Guard. You've had a pretty good career so far and a good one in front of you. For those young people who are thinking about joining the Guard today, what would you tell them?
I would tell them to keep preparing. Again, that's my preparation. Hard work, dedication, persistence. We need persistence. And to set their goals high. Don't stop at being a Lieutenant Colonel. Think of being a general. Think of being the adjutant general if need be. Everything is possible. Anything is possible. Believe it. Achieve it. Conceive it.
Lieutenant Colonel Williams, thanks for joining us today. That was Lieutenant Colonel Trancy Williams, the State Equal Employment Manager for the Department of Military Affairs, Minnesota National Guard. We have links to more information on Facebook and at MinnesotaMilitaryRadioHour.com. We're just about out of time. Thanks for listening to this edition of the Minnesota Military Radio Hour. I'd like to thank our guests for joining us this week. Author, retired Lieutenant Colonel and Tuskegee Airman, Dr. Hiron Mann, Lieutenant Colonel Trancy Williams from the Minnesota Department, or from the Department of Military Affairs, Minnesota National Guard, Commissioner Larry Shalado, the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, and finally, Minnesota's Adjutant General, Major General Rick Nash. Please join us next week as we talk about Gold Star Moms, 3M, and the Freedom Award, Minnesota's involvement in World War II with Doug Becky. That's next Sunday morning at 7, right here on News Talk 100.3 FM. If you have questions for our mailbag, or if you want to check out the podcast of today's show and all our shows, visit us on Facebook and at MinnesotaMilitaryRadioHour.com. I'm Tom Lyons, and I hope that you make a difference in someone's life this week.
Been listening to the Minnesota Military Radio Hour with host Tom Lyons. Tom is the founder and owner of Phalon Partners Limited, a merger and acquisition advisory firm located in Minneapolis. He's also a Vietnam veteran of the United States Air Force. We hope you found this program to be informative and entertaining. This has been a production of KTLK, Clear Channel, MinnesotaMilitaryRadioHour.com, the Minnesota National Guard, BeyondTheYellowRibbon.org, and the Minnesota Department of Veteran Affairs. Podcasts of this program are available at MinnesotaMilitaryRadioHour.com. Thanks for listening.